Okay, thanks, Troy. I guess I'm going to talk about within host dynamics of influenza drug resistance. And we had a few talks this morning about epidemiology of resistance at the population level, which they actually set the stage for my talk very well. So just jump up to outline. I'm going to talk about a little bit in terms of viral replication and mutation of influenza, then development of immune response very briefly. I don't want to go through all the details. Infection in the presence of immunity, and then after that in the absence of immunity. And then I'll talk about mutations in emergence of resistance and the importance of compensatory mutations. Then, and their role in the emergence of drug resistance in the presence of drugs and in the absence of drugs. What I'm hoping to do here is to convince you that the same thing that we saw in epidemiology this morning, we're going to see it in at the individual level. But I want to also to take it a little bit further, and hopefully I can say that good drugs, very good drugs, could be really bad. And I'm going to just show it through some simulation of modeling viral immune dynamics and inclusion of drug resistance and treatment. So, and then finally, some conclusions and future work. So here is actually my model, a very simplified version of what I want to simulate. I have a virus that's infecting target cells in the upper or lower respiratory tract. During seasonal influenza, it's mostly lower respiratory tract. I don't care about inside the box here, inside the nucleus of the cell, because lots of mechanisms happening and mutation happens there, and viral replication and eventually assembly and viral release. So all drugs that Alison McGeer talked about, M2 channels, they actually interfere with their viral RNA replication, and the new drugs actually interfere with the release of viral progeny. That's basically what happens inside, which I don't care about in my model. Outside is lots of new viruses that these guys eventually going to infect other cells, and then replication happens and spread through the epithelial cell. So those mutations inside are kind of random. Okay, I have no control over that. Nobody has. So if those random mutations happen to be resistant to drugs, then that causes a problem. But treatment itself doesn't cause resistant mutations. It's kind of selecting those mutants, because it's killing off those sensitive viruses. Therefore, if we had mutation of resistance, those take over and infect other target cells. So now I'm going to put this simple one, which is basically SI, and let's call it virus, SVI, or target cells, virus, and infected cells. And then I'm going to include two things in the model. One is neutralizing antibodies that is coming out of after infection happens. Then we have some innate immunity, macrophages, dendritic cells, and other things that they actually eat pathogen, chop it and produce antigen specific to that pathogen. They represent it to T cells and B cells. B cells activated, and colon expansion happens, division happens, they go to plasma, and then other memory cells and plasma producing antibodies. These antibodies, they actually neutralize viruses, so the virus cannot actually infect another cell. So that's one part of it. The second part is actually through expansion of T cells, that they go through colon expansion, and some they go into memory for next exposure if we get another infection, and some of them in the process, they actually turn to CTL, that those guys are actually infecting, killing infected cells, and therefore preventing replication of the virus. So we have two different mechanisms to control viral replication. One is antibodies, neutralizing virus. The other part is CTL, that killing infected cells. Okay. So I want to put this one in just a simple model. Well, before I do that, I say something. A few years ago, actually 3 years ago, Waters and others published in Proceeding of the Royal Society a nice paper related to how we actually treat acute infections. They suggested that during acute infections, if we wait for a little bit of time and then start treatment, we can actually avoid drug resistance. And the reason is that if we don't have pre-existing immunity, for immune response to come up and respond to this new infection, it takes a little bit of time. So for influenza, it's usually beyond 3 days. Okay, it reaches peak of immune response between 5 to 7 days. But influenza has bad property for us that it replicates very rapidly. Within, if you look at the slide that Alison McGeer showed on the first day, that influenza viral titers actually peaks between day 2 and 3. So it's basically very fast replicating virus. For immune response, without having pre-existing immune response, it's very difficult to control that disease. So very often leads to, you know, death. So they suggested that we shouldn't actually treat the person in acute infection, not specifically influenza, until some immune response comes up. Once it passes that threshold, then we can hit the disease hard by treating the individual. And that prevents emergence of resistance, because by the time that you start treatment, some level of immunity is up. If resistance emerges at that point when you start treatment, then immune response could actually control resistance because it's got some cause weakness to it, and then that threshold is probably enough for preventing a spread of resistance. Unfortunately, that doesn't work for influenza because influenza is very fast replicating pathogen. So we have to sort of quickly treat individuals. Once we see symptoms and infection is rising, then we have to give them treatment. If they don't have pre-existing immunity, they may end up, you know, having some complications or even leading to death. So that's the problem. But if we start treating individuals, then we have a problem. For this is actually a problem of transferring to 2003 board document rather than 2007. So if we start treating individuals very early, there are two problems with that strategy. Number one is that treatment generally interferes with the generation of immune response, because treatment blocks replication of pathogen, then we don't have enough antigen around, production of antigen is reduced, and therefore colon expansion of T cells and B cells and immune response is reduced, basically decelerates the progression of immune response. That's number one. Number two is that if we start too early, then we have longer time for selection of resistance. These two problems. So I'm going to put all of these in the context of resistance emergence after treatment in the presence and absence of immune response. And also I'll talk about fitness cost, because if we're going to have two things in the model. One is that, as Chris mentioned this morning, sometimes you have resistance coming up with low fitness. It doesn't do much, whether you treat or not. It's not going to cause a problem. But sometimes some mutation happens, which they call compensatory mutation. They actually compensate for the cost of fitness associated with the initial rise of resistance. So they actually enhance the fitness of resistant mutants, and they can compete with the sensitive strain to a large degree. So treatment basically is favoring that's resistant mutants with high fitness. So I'm going to put all of these in a very simple model. I have target cells, let's say upper respiratory tract or lower, doesn't matter. I have some viruses coming to this area, infecting target cells. Target cells is infected with, let's say, sensitive strain, and then after that, target cells may produce viruses which are still susceptible to drugs. But some mutation may happen randomly, and they produce resistant mutants. These are basically low fitness resistant that it don't matter that much. We can treat individuals and nothing happens. And then these mutants also start infecting T cells. If we look at this scenario, I'll show you this scenario is not a big problem because eventually the higher fitness of VS would actually outcompete VR. But if they get a chance to infect, and that infection goes through another round of mutation and causes another competitor mutation, it could go actually to higher fitness for those mutations. So they produce high fitness, which could be 80-90%, very comparable to the fitness of wild type or sensitive, and then they start producing lots of those high fitness mutants. So that's basically my simple model. If I want to put it in terms of equations, it's a little bit more complicated than. I'm not going to go through all of these parameters and equations, but what I want to emphasize here is that this is actually my CTL, killing infected cells, and this is antibodies actually neutralizing viruses. So what I have here, this is what I highlighted here. This is an important parameter that I put CM as initial number of T cell specific to that type of virus, basically pre-existing cellular immunity. So I can start with zero and looking at just naive cells that they start after infection and replicate, or I can start with some numbers which is basically based on pre-existing immunity that I got from previous exposure. So I'm going to start with something very simple. Let's assume that I don't have any resistant round, no resistant mutant. So this is actually providing some kind of illustration for the effect of pre-existing immunity in the absence of treatment or resistance. I could probably use this one. Yeah. So this black curve is basically I have no pre-existing immunity. CM is in my model is zero. I started with 300 or 400 number of cells for naive specific cells for influenza. Well, the range is between 300 to 600 for influenza infection. You can see that it reaches the maximum viral titers within 2 days and comes back. Okay. If I increase that CM by some amount, let's say I put 500 cells from previous exposure, then I'm going to delay the progression of disease a little bit and also decrease the peak of viral titer. As I increase further, the amount of pre-existing immunity is going to further increase the delay in infectious process, at the same time suppresses the viral titer. That's kind of providing illustration for the effect that we've seen in H1N1 pandemic. We have seen a lot of delay in the process, at the same time, asymptomatic infection. Because once you decrease the level of viral titers, eventually it goes to a level that is actually not detectable. And these are kind of asymptomatic infection. It still may be infectious and could transmit the disease, but because viral titer is not that high, immune response is not creating a lot of a storm in the body, so you don't see any symptoms. But that's the effect of having different level of immune responses in the body. So let's go back to something more interesting, which is timelines of infection. Yeah, go. I can't hear you. Yes, but you are putting in the context of antibodies too. I'm not looking at antibodies in this stage. So if antibody is not around, it's probably longer disease, but the level is reduced because they're actually killing infected cells. They're not doing anything to viruses. If you put antibodies in the context, then yes, it's probably pushing the things back too. That's something to look at it. Okay, I'll go further. Timelines of infections. I want to put something also in. Right now, I want to include resistance and treatment in this picture too. So let's simulate the model. I'm looking at. It's a little bit crowded here, but I'll try. Here's time post-infection, and this is viral titers in log scale, and I'm looking at the situation. Okay, the solid blue line is basically no treatment at all. Okay, the blue line, blue curve, which is dotted here, is basically when I start treatment on day two. And dashed one is basically when I start treatment on day one. Okay? And that's basically the profile of sensitive strain. Okay? So if I don't treat or treat very late, like 2 days, which is close to the peak of viral titer, it doesn't matter much. It's basically infection is kind of over. And this is in the absence of compensatory mutation. So and this green line here, the same thing, green curve here, is basically low fitness resistance when you start treatment without treatment, treatment on day two, treatment on day one. Okay? So I'm comparing basically in blue curve with green curve, sensitive with low fitness resistance. Okay? So if I don't have compensatory mutations, it's better to start early treatment because low fitness resistance is not doing much, and if I start very early, I can kill the infection. Okay. Now let's put it in the context of compensatory mutations. Everything the same, but here I have compensatory mutation with a fitness of 60%. It's not really high, but still high enough to cause that problem. So you can see similar things for sensitive and low fitness, but depending on the time of treatment, then this compensatory mutation could cause a problem. So if I start on day two, treatment on day two, I don't have any problem. Because by that time, infection is generally over by, you know, replication of sensitive virus. But if I start on day one, then I have a huge problem, which is basically corresponding to these dotted curves here. So resistant infection takes over. It takes a little bit longer time, but eventually comes up and infects target cell. So this is basically in the absence of pre-existing immunity, but if I put it in the context of pre-existing immunity, it doesn't matter. Whether compensatory mutation is around or not, I'm going to have similar profile, not too much infections, and immune response that comes up take care of that problem. So here is just looking at the cost, different cost of compensatory mutations. Like if this is actually the profile of no treatment for the time post-infection and then target cells relative to the initial number of target cells infecting target cells. When I start with the number, then I reduces over time because target cells are getting infected. So if I look at compensatory mutation with different costs, I can see that the higher the cost, the longer it takes to infect target cells. This is expected. But the interesting part is here, which I'm comparing, I'm putting in the context of timing and efficacy of treatment. This is something that I'm not sure if medical doctors would believe it, but time for a start of treatment, let's say between half a day and 2 days post-infection. And here is drug efficacy, which I'm looking at 50% to 99% in terms of inhibition of replication of sensitive virus. So it's sort of similar to what we saw in epidemiology this morning, that if I start too early and I hit it with a drug that is really, really good in terms of efficacy of preventing or the replication of a sensitive virus, I'm going to have a huge problem for dominance of resistant viruses, because I'm basically selecting those ones with a higher rate. So I'm blocking replication of sensitive virus, compensatory mutations take over, and then huge problem here. So, and if I start treatment relatively late during infection, I'm going to have similar problems, but because of sensitive infection, because sensitive strain takes over and infects all the cells. There is a region here for optimal, basically, treatment time and also optimal drug efficacy. So if I want to start very early in the presence of compensatory mutations, okay, if I want to start treatment very early, I shouldn't actually use the drugs that are highly effective because they can cause bigger problem. I have some kind of optimal drug efficacy, which is about probably 60% or so. But as I delay the start of treatment, is still the same up to 1.5, and then here is kind of sharp increase that I have to use drugs that are highly effective. Okay, and so now the summary of what I said, which were, that's what I said, compensatory. If we have immunity, we don't have any problem in terms of resistance, pre-existing immunity. If we don't have it, then we have to worry about resistance with high fitness. And something that's important, but maybe it's coming sort of, you know, to some degree out of this study, is that when we have pre-existing immunity, it could, to a large degree, actually prevent the development of clinical disease. So we have a lot of asymptomatic infection around, and this is sort of outcome of different levels of pre-existing immunity. So the higher the level, the less likely to develop clinical symptoms. And also there's something related to preventing death, that there's a question between the, a question related to the role of antibodies and also cellular immunity, that antibodies preventing infection and cellular immunity are probably more important in preventing death. So that one is kind of not proven in practice yet, but limitations. I did not include colon expansion. I just approximated with one simple equation that CTLs will be produced by kind of proportional rate to the infection, number of infected cells. I did not include innate immunity, which is basically at the very stage is going to delay that infection a little bit until antigen is produced and infection goes through. Also, I did not include the delay between infection of a target cell until release of viral progeny, because that process takes about 6 to 8 hours or something like that. I'm not sure how that would change the dynamics, but I assume that's going to be more quantitative rather than qualitative. We can extend that model to include all of those factors. It's just a little bit more complicated and probably more computationally complicated. Something that we need to work on it, this is actually a question for biologists, that we don't have really accurate estimates of in vivo parameters in terms of what is the frequency of compensatory mutations. And if we actually find that frequency, then we have the rate. And then what is actually the fitness of those mutants? And we don't have that rate either. Or we're just assuming that 60%, 70%, 80%. I'm not sure if there is any kind of experimental measurement for those mutations. And something else that is actually, I'm not sure if we can address through modeling or any kind of experimental work, is that if a few years ago, actually, resistance emerged in some areas without using any drugs. And people puzzled about that, and then a suggestion came up, and even we showed that the same situation, that probably those resistant mutants at some point enhanced their fitness, and they could spread in the population even in the absence of drugs. But something that is puzzling me is that if we had that situation, what is the process that sensitive strain could actually reemerge again? Because once you have resistance spread in the population in the absence of drugs, it's sort of similar to, for example, a few years back, the sensitive was spreading in the population. So what is the mechanism that you actually eliminate again those mutants and sensitive strain is replaced? That's it.